Britain refused today to recognize President Mugabe's victory in Zimbabwe's elections, saying tens of thousands of voters had been denied their fundamental rights in an election marred by violence and fraud. In a scathing attack on Mr. Mugabe, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said Britain would keep up pressure on its former colony and deny it access to international funds. Citing reports by election observers from the Commonwealth and the Southern Africa Development Community, Mr. Straw said it was clear the elections had been neither free nor fair. While the United States and European countries also condemn the elections and say they will refuse to recognize the Harare government, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has called on the people of Zimbabwe to remain calm in the face of the disputed results. The United States called today for a complete withdrawal of Israeli forces from Palestinian-run areas they have recently entered to help the work of Middle East envoy Anthony Zinni. Mr. Zinni, a retired maritime corps general, arrived in Jerusalem today to resume the search for a truce between Israel and the Palestinians after days of extreme violence. The United States began yesterday to put pressure on Prime Minister Sharon for the troop withdrawal at a meeting between him and the U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Dan Kurtzer. Meanwhile, EU Parliament President Pat Fox said Israel, while entitled to tackle terrorism, was now producing insecurity, not security, in its responses to attacks by Palestinian radicals. To avoid full-scale war, a political platform involving respected world figures was urgently needed, Mr. Fox told DW Radio, ahead of an EU summit in Barcelona. He praised the EU's Middle East envoy, saying Miguel Moratinos was risking his life every day to keep open lines of communication. Israel's widespread destruction of EU-funded Palestinian infrastructure, including medical and educational facilities, was disgraceful and indefensible and could never be seen as to contribute to Israel's security, Mr. Cox added. Indonesia has begun the trial of 18 officials accused of murder, torture, and crimes against humanity in East Timor in 1999. They include the region's former governor, Abellio Suarez, and ex-police chief Timbul Shilain. Human rights advocates who've sought a special UN tribunal said the 18 were only scapegoats and that the authorities had not charged top figures, including Indonesia's then-military chief General Waranto. The UN estimates that pro-Jakarta militias killed more than 1,000 people in 1999 before and after the independence ballot. A Scottish appeals court sitting in the Netherlands has upheld last year's murder conviction against the former Libyan agent convicted for the 1988 Lockerbie airline bombing. Five judges again found Abdel al-Megrahi guilty after 14 days of appeal submissions and new evidence. At his original trial, he'd been sentenced to life imprisonment for killing 270 passengers and crew of Pan Am Flight 103 plus residents of Lockerbie, a Scottish town. Mr. Megrahi's co-accused, Al-Amin Khalifa Fahima, was acquitted. Observers say that the way is now open to file compensation claims against the Libyan government. Serbia and Montenegro have signed an agreement to reshape their Yugoslav federation with a new name and with joint foreign and defense policies. This shelves Montenegrin independence plans for at least 3 years, after which the situation will be reviewed. EU foreign policy chief Xavier Solana, who'd mediated the talks, said the move would stabilize the Balkans. The draft constitution for Serbia and Montenegro, as the grouping will now be called, instead of Yugoslavia, is subject to ratification by its two parliaments. Aside from defense and foreign policy, each republic will operate other government functions autonomously. Montenegro now uses the euro and previously the Deutschmark. Maurice de Clare, DW Radio News. Thank you.
choice newsroom, your most reliable partner in news delivery. Stay with us for morning events and stories that make history and broaden your outlook. Choice Newsroom brings you R2R news, timely gathered and well packaged by a team of prolific news writers. Choice Newsroom, your only choice for reliable information.
Come on, Gina, let's go.
Aha, Jeff, there you are. I've been waiting.
I like the way it moves.
The ergonomic design of the instrument panel puts everything within easy reach.
It's so smooth.
This engine comes with an intercooler for superior fuel economy and maximum power output of 4,200 RPM. It has alloy wheels, superior stability and anti-lock braking system.
Wow, so this is your new official car.
This is my car.
Oh yeah? Can you afford it?
With the Standard Chartered auto loan, you get the car you want at a very competitive interest rate. You have up to 48 months to repay and the monthly deductions are cool. Contact the nearest Standard Chartered bank and benefit from this great facility. Standard Chartered is making life easier.
For the best in paints, be it oil or emulsions, there's just one place to go.
Ingmar Industries Limited.
For a house to remain as new as the first day you painted it, you need only to use the best paints on the market. You need paints that will last and last even after 10 years of painting.
Talk of quality oil and emulsion paint?
That should be the Luxury Gloss Oil and Emulsion Paint.
Did you say the Luxury Gloss Oil and Emulsion Paint?
Yes, you heard me right. The Luxury Gloss Oil and Emulsion Paint. For bulk purchase, contact Ingmar Industries Limited at North Industrial Area, Dadiban Road near the VAT office. You can also call Ingmar Industries Limited on 222826. That is 222826. Ingmar Industries Limited for the best in deluxe products.
Valley Beach Hotel, the most exciting hospitality address in Sekendi, Takoradi. A three-star facility charging one-star rate and offering a room, laptop computers, satellite TV, mini bar, etc. And a modern conference room seating a maximum of 50 and boasting of an LCD data projector and other valuable presentation equipment. For class, serenity, comfort, security, service, good food and incredibly attractive rate, Valley Beach Hotel should be your obvious choice next time business or leisure takes you to Sekendi, Takoradi. You can locate Valley Beach Hotel at 181 Beach Road, P.O. Box 1273AX, Takoradi. You can email them at vbh@idnghh.com. Telephone 031-26900, 26901, 26902, 26903, and 26904. You can also fax them at 031-26905. Valley Beach Hotel, the complete working holiday next.
Direction for your life. A life without direction is a life without focus. Focus on the majors and not the minors. Listen to Youth Platform this and every Saturday at 1 p.m. With Youth Platform, you get the direction that gives you the right focus in life. Remember, it is Youth Platform this and every Saturday at 1 p.m.
One moment, please.
Choice FM. choice, 102.3 FM in studio.
Good evening, Ghana. I'm Christopher Lydon, your guest host this week and next week on this program we call Wide World, a conversation about everything. It's for radio broadcasts on Choice 102.3 FM in Ghana and for internet listeners around the world. Tonight, we're talking about globalization and trying to decode that word. We live in a global village, more and more people living in a smaller and smaller neighborhood, in environmental danger, in economic fortune, in cultural connections. There are no strangers in this village anymore. There are no islands. There's no isolation. There's no escape. So where is Ghana? Where is Africa in this new global economy and this new global culture? Where do Ghana and Africa want to be? Our guest this evening, Dr. Amos Anyamedu from the University of Ghana at Legon, is an extremely well-known and respected political scientist and teacher who is shaping the thinking of young Ghanaians here and around the world. It's an honor for us to have you in the studio. Amos, welcome. There's a lot of stuff to cover tonight. I want to mention also that Dr. Anyamedu is the founder of a brand new website, www.africatalks.org, which is going to be a very, very interesting forum, I think, for all of these questions. Who talks for Africa? What is Africa saying? What is on the mind, especially of young Africa, university Africa, ambitious Africa, Africa in the world? When Africa talks, what does it say today, Amos?
Yeah, well, one of the first topics we try to look at is globalization, actually. I think many of our members have tried to approach three questions. What is globalization? Is globalization new? Is globalization a Newton? And as you said, I think that there's a certain inevitableness about globalization. I think Antonio Giddens says we are living in a runaway world. A world you cannot control. You can feel things happening to you, you cannot control it. And in a sense, yes, the world, time and space in the world is being forged together at a quite quick pace. The point is, are we as Africans central to it? Or is it just something, as one of my musician friends, Amanziba, says, that's happening to us? Are we just a subject? Are we just an object of globalization rather than a subject? I think
that's a big question.
Yes. Essentially, we are inevitably caught in this globalization trend. I don't think that we are mere objects. I think we're shaping it a bit. We could shape it a lot more, and we have to strategize in ways of about ways to make it the train move a little bit more to our advantage. To me, to some extent, the question whether globalization is good or bad, it's in a certain way a misplaced question, because it appears to me that it's become pretty inescapable.
Would it help to just break it down? First of all, and this came up in the program last night, globalization as an economic theory, as a way of doing business, as an alternative to comparative advantage theory of trade. A theory of trade, a theory maybe of dominating trade. That's one area. There's a globalization of culture, which is something quite different, and we'll get to this, but I mean, I think Africa has an extremely central place in the globalization of culture, in the sense that American culture is an African-American culture. The music of the world, the vital music of the world, it seems to me, is all traceable to Africa. A great deal of the style, chic, fashion, sports, sexual fantasy, the whole thing has an African, a clear African pulse in it. Then there's Africa, there's the globalization of the environment, in the sense that maybe we always were, but we're all, the same rain falls on everybody now, the same threat to air and water affects absolutely everybody. Chemical pollution affects everybody almost immediately. Then there's also the globalization of health and disease. An epidemic is a world epidemic. There's the globalization of conscience in a certain sense, the globalization of terror, perhaps. That's an argument. But the globalization of political values, in the sense that the war in Kosovo was said to mark a moment where human rights preempted claims of sovereignty. So we have a globalization of political values. Take it apart in your order, and break the question down a little bit. Where does Africa want to play its part in these several kinds of globalization?
Well, I think in that kind of analytic way, I mean, we should assume that the various globalizations, so to speak, are of equal merit. It appears to me that essentially globalization is an economic thing. It's an economic thing. And to some extent, I would say that the other aspects of globalization you mentioned, I mean, tend to follow that. And essentially, it's in economic globalization that we feel our marginalization to the greatest extent. So that's why, I mean,
I take it as an economic theory. It's a theory of trade. What does it mean to you?
Well, I mean, I heard you mention in counterposition to comparative advantage and so on and so forth. I don't think I'll put it as such a fundamental extent. It's possible, I would see it rather as the sources, the ultimate sources of these liberal theories of trade, like comparative advantage and so on and so forth. So that in a certain sense, the market has triumphed in a very fundamental way. I mean, I think globalization, economic globalization, essentially marks the unlimited triumph of the market, essentially.
Limited triumph of the market again, but meaning?
Liberal values.
One world market.
One world market, essentially.
Free trade.
Apart from in labor.
Yeah, and it's, and, well, explain just what that means.
I mean, just the idea that you can trade services and goods and services without too much restriction from national borders. So that's one of the, I guess, kingpins of globalization, because globalization is really a borderless world. Africa presented a number of interesting experiments trying to hold the market or to politically manage the market in all sorts of ways. It's more difficult to find these experiments now.
So, explain just what you mean by the experiments too.
I mean, for instance, in Ghana, we had all sorts of programs in which, yes, we're not saying that we're not going to trade in the international economy, but our economic development was in many important respects designed in such a way that we could artificially, that is politically, control the impact of the international system on us. For instance, we could say that we would make our imports artificially lower than they were really were, and therefore we could pay our exports only to a certain extent, and so on and so forth. But we justified that on other grounds, like providing cheap food to the urban masses, and so on and so forth. So these are all choices that we made. I mean, like, I don't think they were very smart, but I mean, you could argue that the politicians or whoever make the decisions has sat down and say that this is what we want to achieve, and we're going to work the global market towards that end. Now you don't really have, I mean, that kind of leeway.
Who is driving globalization as you see it? Who's the master of it? The implication always is that the United States is working it for its own advantage. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean,
not only the American market, but consumer interest.
I think the big mantra of the anti-globalization protesters is that, I mean, what we are seeing is actually multinational corporation globalization, corporate globalization.
Yeah.
So that in a sense, when people demonstrate against globalization in Washington or wherever, they themselves, in a certain sense, recognize themselves as globalizers, maybe cultural globalizations, globalizers or value globalizers, whatever. But then they make a distinction between what they call corporate globalization, which is globalization, I mean, driven by for-profit companies and so on and so forth. As I've said, for me, globalization is essentially an economic issue. Therefore, yes, I agree with that point of view. I mean, all this talk about a global village is coming about because we've had this success, this remarkable success of the market mentality. And that is, I mean, essentially, both throughout into the interest of the Coca-Cola's, the McDonald's, I mean, these are actually more visible, but essentially big corporations. And many of these big corporations are American. So to that extent, American globalization, if you want.
Does your heart root for one side or the other? Do you want to frame it that way? I mean, in the United States, this is a kind of memories of Seattle sort of issue, and whether you are with both.
Yeah, I think that the market has become too powerful. I mean, I'll go for a certain constraint on globalization. At the same time, I don't think I want my voice to be taken by what has become almost like the established anti-globalization protesters. In many points, I can see my interest as an African coinciding with them. I don't know whether I would want them to be my voice. I mean, I think what we have to do is to be able to raise African voice directly in these global development debates. So that, I mean, it's not a protester. Well, I guess there were a few African protesters in Seattle or Prague or wherever. But I mean, I don't think many of us are able to go there. So I
put it this way: where would you, on what issues would you want to slow this process down? In terms of environmental protection, in terms of human rights protection, in terms of workers' wages, unionization, protection of local tradition or deference to local circumstance. What are the effects that you see on Africa on any one of those points? And where would you start the fight?
I will start the fight essentially on the economic. And what I'll try to fight for is for more room for maneuver for the African countries. So that, for instance, Japan can say that, yes, for all sorts of particular reasons, we want our rice to be 10 times more expensive than it is on the world market. And they have the room to maneuver to achieve it. So I want that kind of room for African countries as well, so that in certain senses we are able to limit the market, we are able to politically control the market where we think we must. Now, having said that, you see, I'm also
Japan. Japan wants to protect the price of rice. What does Africa want to protect?
I guess actually, I mean, it will differ for African countries, but in Ghana, for instance, I mean, I'm very sure most people think that the weight of the Bretton Woods institutions on our social cities. Although, I mean, they keep telling us they've been helping us to actually at least maintain expenditures in those areas. I think most Ghanaians would see the influence of globalization on our social cities, especially education and health. as having led to a certain constriction of public spending on it. The public provisioning has gone down. Systems for what I guess you would call health insurance in Ghana were a big issue in our last election. But the point is, I think especially in this whole area of social provisioning, many Ghanaians would want the government to be much more active than it's allowed to. I suspect that in certain other areas, many Ghanaians would not want the government to open up. I mean, there have been various surveys done, for instance, about the extent to which the sort of restrictions that people want to see on foreign investment. And for instance, I mean, one thing that keeps coming up is whether foreigners should be allowed to own land and so on and so forth.
Yes.
I'm not saying that, I mean, these things are proper. But the point is, I mean, if we are really sovereign, then we have to have the capacity to reach certain domestic decisions on these things.
Our guest is Professor Amos Anyamedo from the University of Ghana at Legon. We're talking about globalization this evening, and we'll take your calls after a short break for the news.
Attention for some announcements. Special message to poultry farmers. Tigris is back on the market with day-old chicks from Europe and USA. Contact Bernard of Kosher Feed Mills at Laboni with your orders. The next consignment from Europe arrives on the 22nd of March. Call 762383, that is 762383, and confirm your order. Maranatha Power Mission now comes to you this and every Friday at 4 a.m. on Choice FM. Make a date with Reverend Francis Afute and your life shall never be the same. The Revival of Islamic Heritage Society Ghana Office, a humanitarian non-governmental organization based in Accra, in collaboration with the management of the Jaza Clinic at Kansua, is organizing a series of free medical and health delivery services for the communities in Kansua and its environs, which exercises are to be carried out by a team of competent medical personnel led by Dr. Saki, a renowned obstetric gynecologist. The first of these services is expected to come on at the premises of Jaza Clinic in Kansua on Saturday, the 16th of March 2002. Choice FM has vacancies for broadcast journalists for immediate employment. Prospective applicants should contact the front desk of Choice FM with their CVs and relevant supporting documents and letters of application. Applicants should be computer literate. The end of the announcements.
Christopher Lydon. This is Wide World, live on Choice 102.3 FM in Ghana. And we're live on the internet. The address, if you want to listen on the web, is http://196.3.64.16/live.asx. We're talking about globalization with Professor Amos Anyamedu of the University of Ghana at Lagos. We're trying to pull apart this buzzword that a lot of people want to fight about, that a lot of people think there's no defeating. Globalization as an economic theory, as a statement of the reality of a world that gets smaller and smaller every day. Professor Anyamedu, just sum up the economic doctrine again, and specifically what you think a country like Ghana must do, can do, to protect itself from this kind of one ocean economy.
Yeah, I think the struggle in places like Ghana really is for some kind of autonomous space, if you want. And the first point I've made is
a protected space.
Some protected space, I mean, within this global village, I'm just zooming at them. And I think that my sense is that most Ghanaians would want a certain situation in which we're able to provide more for social sectors. And the second thing would be to somehow protect our industries much more than we're able to.
Protect your industries and protect your schools, in a sense.
Yeah.
I'd like to introduce your colleague, your graduate student, Collins Adubempa Brobi, who is a part also of the AfricaTalks.org conversation. Do you want to give us your definition, Collins, of globalization?
Thank you. I think this issue of globalization has attracted several interest from different perspectives.
Are you for it or against it?
It's not easy for me to just start by saying I support or against it, because it has several controversies which we have to digest and get to know the actual meaning of what the expression stands for. And I see globalization as a multidimensional phenomenon which has a political, technological and cultural as well as economic implications. It is a dynamic, ongoing process, a complex terminology characterized by inexorable integration of markets, nations, states, and technology to a degree never witnessed before. It reflects in the way and manner individuals, corporations and nation states are able to reach around the world far more faster, deeper and cheaper than ever before.
Okay.
Now, when we talk about the globalization, the podcast dimension, it expresses itself in the increasing activities of the global organizations such as multinational corporations.
As we say, cut to the chase for Ghana. What does it mean to you? What does it mean to your generation in terms of hopes and risks of being a Ghanaian in the world?
Yeah, okay. I think we are now in an era where we have to depend upon each other. We are in the era of interdependence, and that we cannot go alone.
Yeah.
Without any other, maybe depending upon other nations. So I think globalization is an issue which has to consider interdependence very well.
I want to put it to callers immediately. We'll come back to further definitions of it, but it seems to me also globalization is related somehow to, it's related intimately to the identification of the human genome, to the recognition that we are one species in a scientific way. We are all an African species. And we very probably all have precisely the same brain. This wasn't known until recently. We were thought to be many tribes, we were thought to be many races, we were thought to be very, very different people. That consciousness has almost disappeared. It has not disappeared in a kind of political reality or a social reality, but the scientific reality is clear now, and it's going to catch up with public attitudes. We know, I think, much more deeply that we are one people, and I think it's going to it ought to temper the you know, the economic warfare that may be involved in the whole concept too.
I understand the biological kind of arguments you're making. I mean, what we know from the what we've come to know about the genome means that humankind is much less differentiated than we thought.
Yes.
But also there's a social aspect of things. I think that increasingly, I mean, even within the same race, I think that people recognize the social differences. Like in this country.
And individual differences too.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. But I thought you were making a bit too much. Yes, it's important that we've come to know that genetically we are so close. But that's a good thing to know, but I don't know the extent to which it will really, in point of fact, I don't even know the extent to which it should reshape our attitudes. Because, I mean, the reality we see on a day-to-day basis is a social manifestation of difference, not the biological. And that is getting wider and wider. So that's how people approach things. In fact, I would say that's how we should approach things.
That's a heavy idea that that biologically close that we may be, the social and political differences are getting further and further apart. I question that. What's the evidence of that?
Well, it's just like the number of people living under a dollar a day in the world, and the number of people to whom $5,000 is nothing. The world is deeply changing. Africa Talks, we did a discussion on Independence Day, and somebody actually made a point that in Ghana, for instance, it seemed we were better off maybe in the 1960s than now.
Yes.
Because, I mean, if you look at independence celebration, it was really like independence anywhere else in the world. Whereas I think the implication of what was being said was that today, I mean, even in our dance, we're able to afford a lower form of dance. I don't think that is objectively true, but at least in terms of the bantams and so on and so forth. I mean, the point that she was speaking was that you can merely see the quality of our decorations and so on and so forth are not as they are in other places. Whereas soon after independence, it was less difficult, I mean, to say that. So that there's a certain general perception, and I think, I mean, the metrics show that as well. I mean, if you take the average growth of many African countries, it's actually gone back within the last 30 years or so,
yes,
rather than going forward. So that the difference in terms of opportunities around the world is actually heightening. It's heightening, and I mean, this whole point of migration, if you say, somebody said, if you come and put a new slave ship in Ghana here and say people can have a choice of going, a chance of going into America, although there are certain risks, the ship will be full. This is just, I mean, a mark of the huge differences that people see in their life chances from being in Ghana as opposed to being in Boston or wherever.
That's a fascinating old set of observations. Who was it that said that you could still fill a slave ship in Ghana?
I mean, this has become something of a generalized story, but I'm more fundamental. I think what people are trying to say is that if you look at the difficulty that people go through trying to smuggle themselves, I think the issue of slavery is a bit emotive, and you should be a bit careful about it. But I think the fundamental story of that, I mean, generalized story is that, in a sense, the voluntary forms of migration that we have now, they are not far removed from slavery. I mean, it's like a certain voluntary form of slavery. I mean, people walk across the Sahara to get into Europe to do quite menial jobs. I mean, terrible.
You're talking about boat people who undergo fantastic danger.
Yes, but it's generalized, not just boat people. I mean,
yes,
the high human traffic actually walking across the Sahara, for instance, because, well, not walking, but hitchhiking and so on and so forth, a very, very dangerous transit mode. And people storing away and so on and so forth.
This is fascinating. There are a lot of subjects on the table. I'd just like to invite listeners to join us. The phone is 70-11-100 or 70-11-200. We're talking about the many meanings of globalization, including the economic, the genomic, the political, the social, and the cultural implications of that word. Professor Amos Anyamedo from the University of Ghana is our guest. And you throw out several lines that I am not quick enough to argue with you about them, but the idea that social and economic differences in the world are getting bigger faster than modes of communication or understanding are bringing us together. I hope that's not true, but I wonder.
Well, that's Clinton's argument. That's the third way argument in globalization.
What was Clinton's argument?
Well, Clinton essentially argues, I forgot it was that way, but I mean, all he says is that yes, it's essentially this argument that yes, globalization is bringing us together, but in several ways we're also apart. And I think Clinton's point is that the smart thing is to have a globalization which truly integrates. And what he's saying is that certain aspects are getting globalized and certain aspects are really, I mean, going further apart. And he links like even September 11th to that.
Well, I think September 11th is related to it in many ways. I have a few thoughts. What connection do you make between I make a thematic connection in that I think the World Trade Center will do, it's the closest thing that the world had to a kind of architectural symbol of globalization, this this world market that never sleeps.
Yeah, exactly.
this kind of buzzing, I think of it as it's the market in yen and dollars around the world. Mm-hmm. It never stops.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's always searching out deals and cheap commodities and markets. It seemed to me that the attack on the World Trade Center made sense from the standpoint of an extreme...
An attack on Western globalization.
Yes, mm. Yes. It seems to me, if you had to say, what were they attacking? It was the idea of a single world market. You know, if I can digress, 100 years before September 11th, Joseph Conrad wrote a novel called The Secret Agent about a terrorist attack on the symbol of science in 1900, which was the Greenwich Observatory.
I see.
And it was plotted by... The idea was that the same people were worried about proletarian revolution, radicalism, rising workers, and the thought in this attack on the Greenwich Observatory was we must have a counter-revolutionary attack on the symbol of hope in the great middle class to radicalize England against the lower classes. Against poor people, against the proletariat, against the left wing. And the man who plotted the thing said to his fellows, he said, we must attack, we can't attack just anything. It wouldn't do to attack the king or the church. These aren't that significant anymore. We must attack the sacrosanct fetish of our time, which is science and the promise of science. Well, it seemed to me the people who plotted September 11th may well have said the same thing. We've got to attack the central idea of our time that will really scare the dangerous people in the world, or rally the United States against the people who threaten it in a certain way. September 11th has had a great sort of counter-revolutionary effect in the United States. We're now at war with poor people in a certain sense, and brown and black people around the world, and in some cases calling them the axis of evil. But it seems to me there was an intention somehow, at least by implication in this attack, on the idea of this sort of disembodied world market. A market that was immediately, you know, within a matter of days, the same market was operating out of offices in London. It's a kind of, it is kind of the controlling principle of the world. But where does that get you to say that? Do you accept, do we accept? I wonder if I accept the notion that the World Trade Center embodies threat to the rest of the world. Yeah. Do you think it does?
I don't really think it does. And actually, I mean, although I find your position attractive, from what I've come to know about the terrorists, I myself, I suspect they choose the targets essentially for military reasons.
For military reasons?
I mean, the two towers were sticking out of New York and they were very easy targets. I mean, I think, I hope that we are giving them far too much rationality.
I think so too.
To be, I mean, rationalizing it in this way. But having said that, I mean, yes, it shakes the Western world. It's mind-boggling that so many big corporations are headquartered there, and immediately all these big stock companies and so on and so forth have to be looking for new offices.
They did hit the target that scared the wits out of power in the world, no question.
Yeah. It had that effect. Whether it was also their intention, that's what I'll contest a bit. I want to believe they were not that smart.
Well, I wonder too, but say, what does that imply about the future?
Well, I think September 11th, I like the way Tony Blair put it when he was here. And it's also a bit frightening. I mean, Tony Blair's point is that after September 11th, politics is global.
Yes.
What he meant by that was that, I mean, look, nobody's cared about what was happening in this field state, Afghanistan. Then suddenly, Afghanistan becomes important to the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so what we're going to see is a certain dramatic redefinition of sovereignty. I mean, there's a process that actually has started before September 11. I think it's going to be much easier for big countries to intervene in the affairs of poorer countries. Now, I think that's a dynamic that can easily go wrong. And even before September 11, Kofi Annan, who you know we follow very well here in Ghana, had put in train a whole series of events to try to, if you want, redefine sovereignty for the 21st century world. In fact, he's behind a report which has been produced called The Responsibility to Protect. And that report tries to define on what grounds other countries can intervene in the domestic affairs of others. In other words, on what basis can you relax sovereignty on the altar of promoting respect for human rights or whatever grand value you want to protect. I think that's very important. It was a very controversial process. I mean, that report is a very, very thoughtful report which tries to balance things as the right of individuals to a certain decent treatment from their states and the recognition that the world as we have it today is essentially based on a certain norm of nation states, and the grand norm of nation states is that they have certain exclusive rights, so to speak, over there within their boundaries. So there's always a kind of a tension there. It's quite possible to see a world after September 11, which perhaps pushes the intervention argument a bit too far. I mean, Bush's evil men are not everybody's evil men. I mean, going on the axis of evil analogy that Bush has used. Now, his position is that as far as I'm satisfied that you are promoting terrorism, I have almost a responsibility to come and get you.
Yes.
Now that can, now for now, immediately after, so close after September 11, I think it seems understandable to many of us. But I dare say that in about 2 years, we shall all begin different on who are the terrorists, who defines who is an evil man, and so on and so forth. So it can easily make the world a much more dangerous place.
Do we believe after September 11th, that the world is on a kind of cultural collision? This
clash of civilizations.
Yes, indeed. Or do we believe that, as many people had decided, that the world was on a, some people spoke of the end of history, but the idea that the world was on a sort of path of convergence toward a mixed capitalist economy and a social democratic politics, that in a certain sense the world had decided it wanted to be sort of like Americans, one way or the other. Are we still on a path of convergence toward everybody wanting to live in California, including Chinese people and Africans and Eastern Europeans and whatnot, or do we think that we're now approaching some sort of showdown between maybe the West against the rest, they say, or Europe against Islam or whatnot?
I think somewhere between the two. Somewhere between the two. Somewhere between Fukuyama and Huntington. It's not a clash of civilization, because yes, I mean, we've all been hearing reports of the Gallup poll in Muslim countries. Where
I haven't heard it. What does it say?
I'm essentially, I explained the news about the last 3 days or so. Essentially, they've surveyed a number of countries in the Middle East where Muslims are in the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the big point that comes out of the survey is that people really, the ordinary people, just don't trust America. In fact, I think about 60% say they don't even believe that September 11 was done by, in effect, by Osama bin Laden. They don't think that September 11 was done by Arabs. And even bigger percentages saying that, of course, America is biased towards Israel and all that. I mean, it's a certain very, very skeptical view of America in the Arab world. But I mean, in spite of that, I think that it's obviously not accurate to read September 11 as a clash of Islam against America. I've been quite impressed by the various ways in which various Islamic theologians have tried to explain that that attack cannot be properly Islamic. And the credentials of someone like Osama to speak for Muslims has, of course, been challenged in many places. So it's only in a certain nominal way that I think that makes a clash of civilization. The other thing is, if you look at it from another side, I mean, the end of history. It's not the end of history either. Because if you look at it, I mean, the two big factors, democracy and markets. About markets, as I've said, many people in Ghana, for instance, don't really want really free markets. I don't think so. When you talk about democracy, I think it's, yes, liberal democracy has won in a certain sense. But people also want liberal democracy in their national characters, if you want. People in Senegal want democracy in a certain Senegalese way.
Okay.
And so on and so forth.
This is interesting. There are a lot of important subjects on the table, and much more than I thought we'd ever get into. I want to be the romantic, and we'll pick this up after the news, but just to say that I think we haven't mentioned the internet yet, on which you're a great expert, but it seems to me the internet is one more of those factors that is going to emphasize deep connection, many points to many points, connection of great intimacy, along with culture and genomics, the fundamental biology of the species, that are going to bring things not only more closely together, but more closely together in an African way. We had a very interesting guest on this program two nights ago, John Perry Barlow, who was celebrating the marriage of internet technology and African tradition. He thinks they are made for each other, that the new century and the new technology will really represent a kind of picking up of African values, untainted, untouched, undamaged by the Industrial Revolution, but family structure, family connection, and maybe even religious and musical culture will be reborn in the web out of an African source. Does this sound
interesting but controversial?
yeah. Do you want to take a whack at it before we break?
I've heard it several times before, but I don't want to mention names. But there's a big organization here actually, which is doing very practical things, trying to do these things. I don't know. I think the medium would always affect the message. I mean, there's a big controversy in Ghanaian music about what's becoming a software music. as people generating sounds from their computers, and whether that affects the kind of music that comes out of it.
Well, it surely does, right?
Yeah, actually,
I'm against
it. In that sense, it does. But I mean, there's another computer expert in our university who argues like the way John was arguing that look, we cannot do without a computer. I mean, like, and he argues in very similar terms. It's made for us. I mean, it's going to, and he thinks that it's actually a great opportunity for our traditional forms of music. And somehow, I tend towards the view that there's always a ghost in the machine. I think that the medium always will affect the message in a certain way.
Let's take a short break for the news. We're talking tonight with Professor Amos Anyamedu from the University of Ghana at Legon, and we're trying to make sense of the many meanings of the word globalization. The phone is 70-11-100 or 70-11-200. We're going to come back and wrestle this word to the ground after the news. Don't go away. This is Wide World on Choice 102.3 FM.
CPP react to Professor Mazuri's assessment of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. End of Project Evaluation Forum to assess participants of Women's Leadership, Human Rights and Democratic Participation Training Project ends. And Italy's president calls on Zimbabwe not to abandon democracy. Good evening and welcome to Choice at 10. The details. The Convention People's Party has reacted to comments Professor Ali Mazuri, a renowned African academician, made about Dr. Kwame Nkrumah when he delivered the Agrave-Fraser-Gettysburg lectures under the theme Nkrumah's Legacy and Africa's Triple Heritage, the Shadow of Globalization and Counterterrorism. In a statement issued in Accra today, the CPP said Dr. Mazuri's description of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah as an authoritarian dictator is extreme and biased, and particularly worrying since his views were articulated in the presence of an audience which was largely youthful and comprising predominantly students who have no direct experience of the realities of the Nkrumah era except what they have heard and read from sources hostile to Nkrumah's political heritage. The statement further said, for Professor Mazuri to strip the essentials of the entire Nkrumah era to the narrow human rights denominator and judge him on that basis is most uncharitable, especially coming from an academic of his stature. The CPP therefore challenged Professor Mazuri to reconcile his negative assessments of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah as a failure in the domestic Ghanaian politics with the phenomenal resilience of his legacy and its remarkable enduring capacity in the Ghanaian political experience. An End of Project Evaluation Forum to assess the about 100 participants who benefited from the Women's Leadership, Human Rights and Democratic Participation Training Project has ended in Accra. The forum, which is organized by the ARC Foundation Ghana, an advocacy-based human rights organization that focuses on women's and children's rights protection, was aimed at bringing participants trained at all three workshops they held last year together to expose them to broader networking with some policymakers. The training workshops held last year targeted young women from the tertiary institutions, civil society bodies and government and corporate institutions who are interested in women's equity and equality issues and themselves wanted to acquire the requisite skills to become new paradigm leaders and advocates. Participants were drawn from Navrongo, Damango, Takoradi, Kumasi, Asamankesi, Sunyai, Tamale, Ho, Koforidua, Winneba, Tema, and Accra. On the international front, Italian President Carlo Ciampi has appealed to Zimbabwe's leaders not to abandon democracy following that country's controversial election, which saw President Robert Mugabe return to power. Addressing a joint session of parliament on the second day of his visit to South Africa, he said Africa needed the energy, democracy, good governance, and economic dynamism of South Africa. He said Africa's rebirth was contingent on South Africa's endeavors on the new partnership for Africa's Africans' development. He said Italy and the European Union would support the initiative, saying that Africa's marginalization had to end. Finally, the Congolese government says it has suspended its participation in the inter-Congolese dialogue because Rwandan troops have launched massive attacks in eastern Congo. It said the Rwandans killed several people in the offensive at the town of Muliro on the border with Zambia. However, the government said its delegation would remain at the South African resort, the venue of the talks, in order to give peace a chance. Rwanda is reportedly supporting a rebel faction that is fighting against the Congolese government. That ends Choice at 10, presented by Nandi the IT.
You need news that's timely so you can stay on top of the hot issues. You need news that's accurate so you can base your decisions on correct information. Tune into Choice News Hour weekdays and get all the news you need. Choice News Hour on Choice 102.3 FM. 60 minutes of timely, accurate and comprehensive news that you can rely on. Choice News Hour, weekdays at midday and 6 p.m. Only on Ghana's premier talk station, Choice 102.3 FM.
Hallelujah!
In Search of the Lord's Way is a program on Choice 102.3 FM this and every Sunday evening from 7:30 to 8 p.m. Listen to Brother H. Willie Glay of the Church of Christ. The church is located at Circle, 7 buildings from Telecom headquarters towards Caprice. You can also contact them on 221-237. Worship with the Church of Christ in your community. Remember, it is Church of Christ this and every Sunday evening at 7:30 to 8 p.m. only on Choice 102.3 FM.
Direction for your life. A life without direction is a life without focus. Focus on the majors and not the minors. Listen to Youth Platform this and every Saturday at 1 p.m. With Youth Platform, you get the direction that gives you the right focus in life. Remember, it is Youth Platform this and every Saturday at 1 p.m.
Are you having problems parenting? Don't you think it might be a communication gap? So why not join me, Maxine Okugawa, on Parenting on Choice 102.3 every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. Let me be that bridge to bring happiness into your home. That's Parenting on Choice 102.3 FM.
FM every weekday morning after the 8 o'clock news for your reliable traffic and safety report. This traffic and safety report is brought to you by Choice FM in collaboration with Mobile World Group Limited and your partner.
FM. I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is the program we call Wide World. We're talking tonight about globalization with Professor Amos Anyamedu from the University of Ghana at Lagos. We're talking about the globalization of markets, globalization of culture, the globalization of security, the globalization of the environment, the globalization of the idea of the human species. You can join the conversation at 70 11 100 or dial 70 11 200 and speak your own piece on globalization. And here's the real question: where is Ghana in this new global culture? Where is Ghana in the new global economy? Where does Africa want to be? And what does it want to say in this new global conversation? Professor Anyamedu, I wish you'd talk a little bit about specifically Ghana and Africa in general in the global culture. What is Africa's, so to speak, comparative advantage in the cultural evolution?
Well, I guess as many of would agree, Africa has all the content. Other people take the money. Historically, I think that, I mean, if you talk about culture, I mean, that's an area that appears to me we are quite significantly endowed. I mean, you talk about music, you talk about design motifs and all that. I think the challenge has been to find a way to master the process of translating these obvious resources into words. I understand most of the kente, I mean, stores in New York actually manufactured in Korea. Yeah.
Is this true?
That's what I hear. I'll be lively informed. Yeah, I've not bought a Korean kente yet. That's what I hear. But definitely, I think that's there. I mean, look at the sophistication of the kente design. I mean, this is really deep stuff. I don't think we've made enough money out of it. So the challenge really is whether these new technologies offer opportunities for us to make a bit more money from it. One of the most interesting stories I heard about from the internet is how people can buy carvings from the Santa Ynez carver direct on the internet. Now that's powerful. I mean, if you're sitting in Upper State, New York or something, and you can order a stool or whatever direct from the carver who comes from the Santa Ynez. I mean, that guy should be selling stuff for thousands of dollars. I don't think he is, actually.
What is the problem? Why in the world are West Africans stoves made in?
who can pass as a evenly fair bidder, then you stand to make some money out of it. So that, for instance, you see, there's this whole big explosion about interest in indigenous development, knowledge, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of schemes going all over. We just had a big conference here by the World Intellectual Property Organization, which touched on aspects of these things, how to legally protect yourself, so that, I mean, being the motto of all this interest in music and so on and so forth, translates into some dollars in your hands. So it's a long struggle, but it appears to me that steps are being taken. And you see, the musicians keep complaining that the governments, our governments especially, just don't recognize the potentials of these intangible things. And I, that is something that I myself have come to. I mean, we just don't get the importance of the weightless economy. The typical African, politician is thinking about bricks and mortar.
Yes.
When the actual money is being made elsewhere. So we've not given enough support, I think, to our musicians and so on and so forth. From what I understand, in this country, for instance, musical equipment is taxed as a super luxury good. So what is really the working tool for most musicians is taxed as a luxury good that a millionaire will play with. On that same basis, I don't think our governments have done enough trying to protect our indigenous values in these things when people exhibit our stuff. Do we have enough protections? Do we have agencies for protecting the actual generators of this knowledge, whether it's a picture or a painting, a design or whatever?
Collins, I want to hear your view on Africa's place in the global culture.
Yeah, I think culturally we see the poor African products used not to be liked by the white man. But these days we see that a lot of things that are being produced in Africa which are being patronized by the white man. And then we also look at the way the people also dress in Africa, new African dresses. Now, most of them are being European type. So the way we dress, and then there's most of the music that we have and we play. So there are a lot of things culturally that we see that it's having an effect, like, but this is having an effect culturally.
You know, Professor Onyemito, you really blow my mind with the whole idea here that the trick will be to sort of capture the value. I'm not sure that that's ever possible. Is it really to I can't think of it in terms just of making a money return on this kind of expressive energy. But I'm just going to have to sort of rethink it.
Well, I think that, you see, I mean, the point is we are obviously so rich in a certain domain.
Yes.
And so poor in many other domains.
Yes.
So naturally you want to translate some of your strengths into the areas where you are poor.
Well, of course. This is what I'm just getting used to thinking about. But I'm trying to think, what is the precedent for this? Has it ever has a culture, has a nation, has a continent, has a people ever been able to sort of make the price on its culture?
Well, I think that's a new, very funky of economic development thought. I mean, the whole relationship between culture and
culture has, first of all, it has its own value and its own power and its own influence. In the sense that, somebody said sort of a commonplace, but better to be able to write the songs of the world than to write the laws. To write the songs of the world is a power, commercial value, I think it's about time.
No, I'm sure as a Boston man, you can afford this kind of post material. I'm not sure you're really expressing a certain post material value. But for people who have not been tasted the beginnings of materialism, I mean, I'm telling you, if you go to the village, and in fact, I think that to some extent also, we've actually not placed enough value on the things we have. Like, you'd be surprised. I mean, at our Africa Talks session, I met a photographer who takes immaculate photographs. I mean, in most places in the world, he could easily sell a photograph for about $1,000.
Yes.
So I asked him, how much do you sell the photograph for? He says 50,000 cedis. And he's happy with that.
Which is how many dollars?
Less than $100.
And how does that work?
We don't have a value. It's very difficult, even for the creators, to put value on these intangibles. If somebody composes a song, I mean, we have several cases of musicians dying poor. I mean, in part it's because the music industry is, of course, not peopled by the nicest people in the world.
Right.
But also, I think that as a society, generally, we've not put enough value on intangibles for a very long time. So when you get an economy which is moving more towards that area, then we get into big trouble. Because I think that structurally, I mean, both for the modern sector and, I mean, for capturing these kinds of traditional industries, that's the challenge that we face, that the future of economic development is moving from bricks and mortar to increasingly intangible services.
This is so interesting. Poets always die poor, don't they?
Yes.
Yeah. And often young and sometimes, you know, out of print and heartbroken.
That's true.
On the other hand, no, I hear what you're saying in terms of even the rock bands always lose out to the record companies.
Yeah.
And the creative people in almost any industry.
They're not the richest.
Yeah, they get the short end of the stick almost automatically.
Yeah.
It's just that making money and making art and having cultural influence are all very different orbits. But I can understand entirely why the members of the band and the songwriters, and in this case the Africans, feel it's their due. We owe them.
Yeah.
Let me just say the phone is 70 11 100 or 70 11 200, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on the meaning of globalization, the globalization of music and culture and security and the environment and disease and economics. Who is going to make the money on this amazing vitality of African culture? 70, 11, 100 or 70 11, 200. There are other aspects of sort of the specifically African piece of the story. You feel Africa, first of all, it seems to me, well, the one really great hero of world politics alive in the world today, it seems to me, is African, and Nelson Mandela. I mean, the one symbol of a great revolutionary success who became a democratic success and a symbol finally of reconciliation and hope. There are lots of other ways in which it seems to me the world the world turns to Africa for maybe even a spiritual renaissance. Are you a believer in general in this romantic slogan of an African renaissance, on its own feet, but an African renaissance in the world? What about an African renaissance in Africa?
Well, I think the idea of the African renaissance is getting harder and harder. It's getting harder, and it's been, I mean, in a sense, the new development plan that we have, NEPAD, NEPAD is essentially, for as far as I'm concerned, quite clearly connected to the African nations. I mean, Mbeki, for instance, who is, I guess, most closely associated with the new idea of African nations, which really is an idea which has been around for quite some time. I mean, Nnamdi Azikiwe, we actually had a book on that title, I mean, about 50 years ago. So, President Thabo Mbeki increasingly talks about African nations in hard economic and political terms.
Just what does he mean by that?
I think, well, it's two terms. First, Africa has been historically great, and now it can be great again. Africa has been historically great, and now it can be great again. When I say that, I mean, the harder perspective on African nations I prefer, I mean, starts from the position that our recent history has not been that great, but we're going to make it great. So it's an optimism over a much shorter time span.
Hmm. We haven't spoken or barely spoken of AIDS as a global disease with a special African burden. Put AIDS in your general picture of globalization.
That's an interesting one. Well, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, AIDS has become a very difficult African challenge. I mean, only yesterday or the day before, I think, somebody was making the point that, of course, AIDS, when AIDS began, it was not an African issue at all. And I mean, his point was that we didn't strategize enough, and AIDS has come to hit us in this way. If you look at the metrics that people are putting out, it's simply frightening. Yes, there's a certain global dimension to it. I know people say AIDS originated from Africa, but we know that in its most manifest form, AIDS was something that was supposed to be happening to homosexuals in California and so on and so forth. And there are people who have been able to prove that the beachhead of AIDS in Africa, I mean, at least over the last 20 years or so, were at points, the most global points, Mombasa and so on and so forth.
What is your understanding of why it devastates Africa so disproportionately?
Well, of course, I mean, public health in Africa is very basic. Our capacity to communicate is very, very basic. So that, I think a lot of studies have been done about the patterns of growth in Eastern Africa, for instance. I mean, you have these lorry drivers and so on and so forth, essentially driving AIDS into the communities.
How does that work? I'm not sure what you mean.
As I said, I mean, whether AIDS began in Africa or not, it's much easier, and it's been much more rigorously shown that the pattern, the epidemiology of the disease was first at the points of international contests, especially the seaports. And from the seaports, the disease spread along the main carriageways.
I see.
And the importance of that, of course, I mean, the assumption here is that you have seafarers who we all know tend to be quite beginners and travel around a lot. Now you get into contact with lorry drivers who have girlfriends and concubines all along the routes. So that's how the disease spread. And when the disease went into, I mean, let's imagine, for instance, a lorry driver who is driving from, let's say, Mombasa to Nairobi.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's a short distance, but let's say driving even from Mombasa to, let's say, Lusaka. He has a girlfriend all along the road. So this, I mean, lorry driver infects, let's say, three women along the routes. These three women are perhaps more rooted in traditional communities. So the disease is then introduced into traditional communities where the state has almost no ability to transmit messages, where there's almost no health service and so on and so forth. So in that environment, of course, I mean, the capacity of the velocity of the disease goes up and up. And I think that's essentially the story in Africa. It's just like a new diseases, well, that is more of a biological issue, but it's not too different. Like new diseases killing of Aboriginal communities. I mean, the contest, our contest, everything about our social contest was just not tuned to that kind of control. I mean, AIDS has become a sort of a minority issue in America, in Europe, because you have agencies of public health control.
You spoke of the metrics of the disease, truly scary projections of numbers. Just what you what are you speaking about?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in South Africa now, I've forgotten, it's 4 out of every 10 are supposed to be infected. In Botswana, it's maybe even more frightening than that. Here in Ghana, many people think that we've grossly underreported, I mean, the figures. But I mean, essentially, if you look at this, we are going to kill all Africans off very soon if it continues growing the way it is.
Well, this is a paradox to me. People speak of these horrendous rates. You say 4 out of 10 in parts of South Africa, and yet people don't talk about great devastation of population and numbers. In other words, the population still will grow. Apparently, we're not talking about a depopulated continent yet.
No, well, as I understand it, demographers are beginning to account for AIDS in the estimates. I don't remember the figures, but I've seen references where the population growth rates have been discounted because of AIDS.
What is AIDS going to do to the population of Ghana?
Honestly, I don't even know where Ghana stands, but from what I understand, everybody agrees that in Ghana we've grossly, the handle we have on the rate of infection is very low. I don't know what the prevalence rate is supposed to be, but I think it's less than, it's about 2 in 10, if my memory serves me right.
2 in 10?
Yeah. People are infected.
Yeah.
Am I right?
I think it's about 200 infected per day.
Yeah. I don't remember the specific figure, but I know, I mean, the first Africa Development Forum was on AIDS. And I think the idea was that if you reach above 4%, then you are almost, I guess even 2% is deep trouble, but 4% is like almost irrecoverable, trouble. And from my memory, Ghana was about half of that in about 2 or 3 years ago.
And what do you take to be the measurable effects of that infection rate in terms of family survival, in terms of population growth, in terms even of national survival, in terms of professional development, in terms of burden on governments? I mean, tick off what you take to be the main sort of effects of that kind of infection rate. What is it going to do to Ghana?
Well, I think it does not strike in a very obvious manner. Because I think one of that things is that even without drugs, it appears that the gestation period of the infection is a bit longer than many of us assume. In the sense that it's increasingly, you hear various people being HIV infected even for about 10 years before they get full-blown AIDS. And these are guys who are not even on drugs. So, but the point is, we also know that it's eventually going to kill you. I've seen studies, a CIA study on the effect of AIDS on African militaries. And it's a quite frightening kind of study. Essentially, as you can expect, the military tends to be more infected than the total population.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I don't know, the various ways that the CIA has for knowing. What they're trying to project is that AIDS is going to quite significantly affect the capabilities of African militaries. And it's not only that AIDS affects, affects the military more than it affects other sectors of society, but also the more skill-intensive aspects of military work tend to be, those working in those areas tend to be more infected. So there are specialized areas like signals, cash office, and so on and so forth, tend to have more infected soldiers, and so on and so forth. And that's not, the most obvious example, but if you look at it, even with the amount of military power that we have now, the amount of disorder that you have to deal with. If our military institutions are put out by the AIDS epidemic, I mean, that's an obvious development effect.
I'll say, you know, could I just say to listeners, this is the program we call Wide World. I'm Christopher Lydon. I'm a talk show host in the United States, privileged to be guest host on Choice 102.3 FM this week and next. Our guest is Professor Amos Anyamadu from the University of Ghana at Legon. I meet your students every day. A man of wide influence and wide learning, well known in this country and elsewhere in the world too. We're talking about the many meanings of the word globalization. And the phone is 70-11-100 or 70-11-200. Most pointedly, what is Africa's place in this new world? A world that has, what, four times as many people in it as it did 100 years ago? A much smaller place with a much bigger human burden. What is Africa's place in the new globe? Professor Anyamadu's website, www.africatalks.org, is significantly devoted to this conversation. You can check that too. It's just begun. It's been up about a month. I've only seen a few days of conversation on africatalks.org, but I'm very much interested in what your students, who are being born professionally, so to speak, into this world, make of the word globalization. Is this a scare word? Is it an opportunity word? Is it a sort of reason to travel, expand, study, or is it a kind of hunker down and get ready for a sort of further assault from the powers in the world? What do your students say about globalization?
Yeah, I think there's a range of thought on that. But on the whole, I think what impresses me by what students have contributed to the site is that they tend to see globalization in quite operational terms. In other words, if you read most of the postings on the site, people are relating to globalization in an everyday manner. It's not seen as an abstract in the air.
Right. And they're afraid of it.
I would say most. I think
between
the majority are worried. At least worried about it.
Mm. And what dimensions are they worried about? I mean, again, we're talking environment, disease, security, economics, culture. What's the worry?
Collins.
Yeah.
Collins Adubempa Brobi. What do the students feel is the danger?
We see that the widespread of diseases, and then with looking at the African status, the African people are seen to be impoverished people. You know, we lack a lot of things, and we are the literacy rate also very high. So any attempt of any outbreak of any disease also had to go a long way to affect a lot of people. So you see that it's posing a whole lot of danger to Africans. So we are, students are all very much, afraid of how things are being, the health hazards and all these things are prevailing.
The globalization of disease.
That's right.
Yeah. Do African students in the year 2002 feel like citizens who can move in the world or not? I've never thought of the visa problem from an African standpoint, but what is it?
We've gone preaching a good governance and democracy. I mean, I think most of these issues has to be tackled by the leaders if you are to have it, leaders with good vision. And I think we also have vision. And then we'll have a good hope for ourselves. But just like the leaders themselves have to be up and doing, and a lot more of talking has to be, cut down, and then we do the practical things. So I think that's how I see it to be. That we hope to have a future if we live there.
I visit your campus every day. It's a beautiful campus.
Yes.
And full of interesting and promising young people. But I haven't had a chance to talk with them about where they go in the world. I keep hearing about a brain drain out of Ghana, but I don't know from the students themselves what they want to do, whether a tide has turned.
I think yes, it's a problem. It's a problem the financing students in this country, especially, because most of the students are also as a job doing over there. So that is tuition.
Amos, you see many students of many ambitions. Where do they want to serve? Where do they want to make their reputations? Where do they want to make their fortunes?
I'm sure the majority would want to go out.
Yes.
The majority would
really?
Go out. Yeah, I think in this country we've become much smarter. I mean, somewhat we're developing this idea of global citizenship. I mean, I know that the present government, for instance, I mean, the previous government used to have one. You owe us a responsibility and so on and so forth. But I think that, of course, in the narrow sense, I mean, where responsibilities are due, like bond the students and so on and so forth, even the present government will have to argue for them to be here. But increasingly, I can also hear that, well, you can go, but remember that you are Ghanaian, and I mean, contribute to the development and so on and so forth. I suspect that's a positive term. I mean, whenever I teach globalization, I mean, I make a point of coming in with a remark by one of my best friends, Bernard Fono. Fono works with the Third World Network, which is Sami Amin's organization. And his take on globalization is that the West is trying to globalize everything apart from the movement of labor. And that's something which means that, yes,
what does that mean? The West is trying to globalize everything but the movement of labor.
Yeah, what he means by that is that all the factors of production, there's a lot of pressure to increase the velocity of all the factors of production, capital especially.
Yes.
But labor, there is, a strong interest in
the skills,
in actually dampening the mobility of labor, or most forms of the mobility of
labor. Keep your poor people where they are.
Keep your poor people where they are. But if you have some money, of course, your money can go everywhere you want. So I think it's
mobility of capital, immobility of work.
Immobility of exactly that's the idea. And my students relate to that very well. When I was a student,
what do you mean they relate to that? They understand it, or
they understand it and they recognize it as something that affects their life chances. What is it? For instance. Most of the students, as Collins was saying, tend to travel out during the long vacation. And I'm not sure, I don't know the percentages, but the demand for letters of introduction to the embassies and so on and so forth. And the students I myself meet in Europe, I mean, I'm sure I meet many people, many more students and former students on the tube in London, for instance, than walk in the streets of Accra.
Really?
Serious?
I'm very sure about that. Well, I mean, it's not very scientific, because I suspect that if a student sees you in London, he or she feels more compelled to identify himself than if he sees you in a crowd.
Yes, that's true.
But definitely there are a lot of Ghanaian students, Legon students, especially in the big cities, in London, in Chicago, well, to a lesser extent in Chicago, but many more in Chicago than I thought I would meet. It's very common for students to travel, I mean, within the last 6-8 years, I would imagine. When we were students, very few of us.
Well, I understand that gifted professional Ghanaians can still have difficulty getting visas to the United States.
That's true. I think it's much easier for students to get visa. I think so.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
And where can a young Ghanaian hope to go in the world? Are there easier channels than others? Is the United Kingdom, for example?
I mean, London is a very... of course, they're able to make some money during their short spells during their vacation, because some of us, they piggyback on established relatives. So, I mean, they go where the Ghanaian communities already are. And London, I think, is by far the most important. How many students do they go to do all summer jobs and so on and so forth? They might come with, I don't know, 2,500 pounds, and that helps them through the course. It appears as very popular. Many students own cars on the campus now. When we were students, very few students had cars, and many of those with cars normally go out and work.
But now, what is the value of that definition of globalization? The fact that a bright Ghanaian student now can also think of himself in a certain degree as a citizen or a resident of London or Paris or Chicago or Toronto.
Well, in Africa, I don't know the importance in terms of proportions. When I first came to Ghana, I used to spend a lot of time in Senegal, Dakar. And what hit me was that the students at Dakar University were much more globalized than students in Ghana.
What does that mean?
In a sense, like, you can see their outing, their dressing and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the student in Dakar is really like a student in Paris and so on and so forth. And in Ghana, you could immediately tell that luckily you're in an African country. But looking at Legon, for instance, now I can see that actually it's not the majority of students, it's still a minority. But increasingly, and I think it's down to this thing about the traffic between Legon and London especially, I mean, many students on the campus, there could be students in any provincial English university. I mean, tens of their outing.
In terms of?
Their outing, T-shirts and jeans and jeans.
What about their reading? What about their knowledge?
Well, that aspect is very, very different. I mean, Ghana is, I think, a seriously under-mediatized society. I mean, I think the media in Ghana, the local media, I think we have a long way to go. So, I mean, at least in my experience, and I want to think that teaching political science, you tend to get the students who are more interested in public affairs. I think once, and I've taught on many continents in the world, you see, our students are much sharper. Their aptitude is much, much sharper. But they sharper than most students I've taught in North America or Australia.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely, I think. But their orientations, I think, tend to be more limited in the sense that they don't read widely enough and so on and so forth. And that's something that applies to all of us and I put together. So the exposure to general affairs in this country, I think, is very, very limited. And of course, we make up for it by our oral culture and so on and so forth. But generally, there's a problem there. The society is heavily under-mediatized.
Under-mediatized?
Yeah.
Compared to other African countries too?
That's a good question. I think so. Definitely compared to Nigeria, at least from what I can see from their newsstands. Compared to Nigeria, definitely compared to Dakar. I don't know enough about African countries, but I mean, definitely compared to Senegalese students, I would say so.
And speak about media more particularly. What about, you're talking about print, you made a comparison between tabloid, but what about television, most particularly radio and talk radio?
Well, I'm on choice, I don't know what to discuss talk radio. Actually, the last time I was here, I had a big quarrel on whether the media is doing enough. When I came back from leave, the first paper I did was actually on talk radio in Ghana. Yes, I mean, it was a whole new phenomenon, and I thought it was very important. I mean, I did a paper, I did a public lecture in Legon on talk radio and the public sphere. Generally, from speaking for myself, I've been quite disappointed because, I mean, we seem to be stuck. It's important, it's the newest form of our public sphere, but the quality of information on degrading it, I think, is quite weak. The quality of public information is quite weak. Like, I'm not talking about All Things Considered or even anything like that. But you listen to most of these talk shows, and really all that they are doing is opening up the airways for generally unmediated opinion.
Unmediated opinion meaning?
Oh,
unsophisticated.
Well, not unsophisticated, but you see, I mean, we have various, I mean, type of, actually, I should be careful speaking to somebody like you, but you can have the Howard Stern kind of talk show host, eh?
Right.
A shock jock. He comes in and he shocks you and so on and so forth. You can have a talk show host, I suspect you get on public radio in America, for instance, where it's like he's hitting you with this seriously research perspective, hitting you with lots of information. Or you can have a more neutral kind of guy who, I mean, that one we're beginning to have quite a bit. I mean, the interesting thing happening in the media in this country is the interconnection of the different processes. Like, I think the most important thing that these talk shows are doing now is actually reading the newspaper comment on air. So translating it from the press into, I mean, the electronic media. I mean, they've become very good at that. But apart from that, not many of the talk shows are actually providing, before the discussion of general opinion, a certain cognitive information basis to say that, well, this is where we are and so on and so forth. And perhaps the guy in charge of the show will then say, but this is my opinion. Normally what they'll say is that, well, today we are discussing the budget. And he will come with his own opinions. What do you think? And what we have is a series of opinions, and we don't really have, as far as I'm concerned, the level of discussion is really like, oh, I think this way, he thinks that way, so and so. The basis for trying to make a certain comparison of opinions is not really provided on most of these shows. And I'm not saying for all of them, but most of them.
I want to let callers speak to that point. Professor Anyamed is saying some important things about the way talk radio works or doesn't work in Ghana yet. I would differ with you in my reading of the callers, and I want to give you my own sense, but I want to let the callers speak for themselves if they want to. The phone is 70 11 100 or 70 11 200. From my own experience, I've done a lot of talk radio in the United States on the public radio, sort of all things considered part of the radio band. Which can be considered sort of slightly upper income, upper education, and in the United States is densely, you would say, mediatized culture. We're bombarded with information at every level, every day. But I would say, first of all, talk radio in the States has been a terrific answer to the dumbing down critics. I think what talk radio shows me is that the country is a great deal better educated, and maybe that would be my quick judgment on Ghanaian callers. They're extremely articulate and well motivated. They talk about making contributions to a conversation, building something, and like all of us, they know more than we think we know. They bring a great deal of life experience, and maybe political prejudice to almost any question, but they know who they are and they're very, very able to express it. To me, the talk radio is a terrific affirmation of the kind of a kind of public treasury that we don't always remember we have. In the United States, again, against an image of terrific division or general stupidity, I think talk radio is a great confirmation of the constructive energy in a society. And I would hope it would work that way here. I would gather that's what Choice had in mind in sort of going the talk emphasis.
Yeah.
I think it's a terrific democratic forum. I've done a lot of print journalism on the New York Times and the Boston Globe, and I did television for almost 15 years. I've learned more about the country doing talk radio than I did reporting in any other medium, and I think it's been good for me as a human being to have to sort of learn to interact with strangers who in most cases know as much as I do about almost anything.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I mean, my I'll find a paper for you. My interfaculty lecture was exactly on these things. Yeah, I mean, talk radio has done all those things. I got interested in it because the day on which I arrived in the country from Leeds, the driver who took me from the airport to my flat, I mean, like, he gave me a complete and reliable lowdown on politics in this country.
I mean, in Ghana.
Yeah. I mean, very competent analysis of, I mean, the issues and so on and so forth.
That's what I mean. We know so much more than
exactly. So all that is, I mean, true. I think my pessimism is coming in. I mean, it's coming in from several, I mean, dimensions. Number one, I think that somehow the quality of that CA has gone down. In fact, when in what was this? I think early 98 when I came back, talk radio was actually limited to a few stations. Radio Universe was, as far as I could determine, Radio Universe, a university radio station, was really the station that started a revolution. And at that time, Choice was a music station actually, and they had talk shows on a few of their programs, and also, yes, Radio Universe was already using the vernacular, but there were not many talking phoning programs in the vernacular, and so on and so forth. But now, as the talk format has been broadened, I think its attractiveness, I mean, from a assessing deliberation point of view, has tended to go down. And by that time, which I think is really dangerous, is that...
What is it going down? Is it sort of
The quality of deliberation, I think, is going down. The quality of deliberation.
Deliberation.
Yeah.
How do you measure deliberation?
Well, I know it's very difficult to measure it specifically, but at least from my my own for my purposes, I go back to the point I made about the, let's say, the bedrock of information on which they are operating. Like a concrete example I had with my driver.
Okay, hold it right there. We're going to take a short break for news. We call this program Wide World, a conversation about anything tonight, about mobilization, with Professor Amos Anyamedu. We'll be back after the news.
Tension
tension still mounting in Wa Secondary School. Madagascan security forces shoot and kill several demonstrators, and Zambian journalists and staff at Biggest Daily go on indefinite strike. Good evening and welcome to Choice at 11. About 300 Orthodox Muslim students of Wa Secondary School have packed bag and baggage and left the school in solidarity with their 14 colleagues who have been arrested for allegedly burning down a tutor's bungalow and vandalizing school property. The students have also threatened to maltreat other Muslim students still staying in the school and will vandalize more school property if their colleagues are not released. The headmaster of the school, Mr. Moses Donayung, told the Ghana News Agency in an interview at Wa that classes are, however, going on for the remaining students. He said the school has been thrown into a state of insecurity as the tutors have also started packing their belongings to relatives in the Wa town for fear of vandalization. Mr. Donayung has therefore called on the police and other security agencies to step up their patrolling activities on the campus. He said the students who have voluntarily left the school are misinforming people in town that the school authorities are discriminating against Muslim students. Security forces in Madagascar have shot and killed several demonstrators opposed to President Didier Ratsiraka at the main port of Toamasina. Four people were killed in Toamasina, Ratsiraka's home base, on earlier this week in the worst bloodshed since a leadership crisis began in Madagascar in December last year. The violence marks a sharp upturn in unrest after weeks of peaceful protest in which opposition supporters have demanded that a veteran ruler resign. Supporters of opposition candidate Marc Ravalomanana seized control of government ministries in the capital of Antananarivo earlier this month. Ravalomanana insists that he won presidential elections in December last year. He has declared himself president since and has even appointed a cabinet. And Zambian journalists and support staff working for the country's biggest daily newspaper, the state-run Times of Zambia, have gone on an indefinite strike. The Zambian Union of Journalists says media workers are demanding raises and improved working conditions. A representative of the union says they have asked the government to suspend the entire company management and improve conditions of service. The Times of Zambia is the oldest and most widely circulated newspaper in the country. Zambia has three daily newspapers, one of which is privately owned. That ends Choice at 11.
About leopard? Some think leopard is an animal, but it's not. NEPAD stands for New Partnership for African Development. An agenda talk on Choice 102.3 FM will be running a whole series on NEPAD. What opportunities and challenges NEPAD offers to African countries and why the G8 countries have shown interest in NEPAD. So, make a date with Choice Agenda Talk right here on Choice 102.3 FM, weekday mornings from 8:30 till 10. NEPAD, coming soon on Choice 102.3 FM. Choice FM, 1 year on, we've got the nation talking.
What a wonder you are.
Indeed, the entrance of the Word of God gave that light. It throws light into the situation that you find yourself. That's why you don't have to miss this powerful sermon of Reverend Christy Doitete, General Overseer of Solid Rock Chapel International, on this station Choice 102.3 FM. Listen every Saturday at 6:30 a.m. We are talking about the Word of God that changes man's position from worst to best, from ugly to beautiful, and from curses to blessings. Make time with Reverend Christy Doitete this Saturday from 6:30 a.m. only on your True Global News and Information Radio Station Choice 102.3 FM. What a wonder you are.
Are you having problems parenting? Don't you think it might be a communication gap? So why not join me, Maxine Okugawa, on Parenting on Choice 102.3 every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. Let me be that bridge to bring happiness into your home. That's Parenting on Choice 102.3 FM.
Direction for your life. A life without direction is a life without focus. Focus on the majors and not the minors. Listen to Youth Platform this and every Saturday at 1 p.m. With Youth Platform, you get the direction that gives you the right focus in life. Remember, it is Youth Platform this and every Saturday at 1 p.m.
Choice 102.3 FM. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Wide World, a program of conversation about anything we want to talk about. We've been talking tonight about the word globalization, a word of many meanings, with a student of all of them, Professor Amos Anyamedu at the University of Ghana in Lagos. The phones are now open for Ghanaians who stay up late and want to talk about globalization or media or politics or the environment or security or the human genome. The phone is 70 11 100 or 70 11 200. Feel free to join the conversation and take it where you'd like. Professor Anyamedu, you were talking about media, and I want to come back to it, sort of press in Ghana, talk radio in Ghana. What about television in Ghana, incidentally?
Kind of disappointing.
Well, it's disappointing everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, like in Ghana, I mean, like on our national television, and I don't know, I mean, a network which calls itself African, it's literally taking away a national television. And for prime time, what you have are these old American soaps all the time. It's disgraceful and unbelievable, actually, as far as I'm concerned.
Is anybody watching?
I guess so. I mean, for a national television that we have to pay a license for, that's disgraceful, I think.
What is the disgraceful part?
What they've done is, I mean, this private firm has literally bought all the prime time hours. I think it's something like from about 8 o'clock to midnight or something, and all these shows are these old American soaps. I mean, can you believe that?
Well, this is the story around the world, isn't it?
I think television in America is pretty terrible, but Ghana television now is the worst I've encountered in the world.
How many channels can Ghanaians get?
The situation is beginning to change a bit. I mean, if you are in Accra, your menu is very different from if you are in Kumasi, for instance. I hear there are about two new stations in Kumasi that I have no clue about. But in Accra, you get three?
Yeah, three. Yeah. Metro and TV Premier. Yeah.
Yeah. If you are a rich man, you can subscribe to all the charity channels. Yeah.
But how many of them are American? Probably 99%.
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting thing is one of them is actually owned by Malaysians, and they are buying a lot of South American soups. So okay. You can choose between North American soups and South American soups.
But is there enough exposure to television in this country to worry about the the, I don't want to say pollution, but the kind of the cultural imperialism, the cultural bombardment?
I think there is. And I mean, the television sets are becoming cheaper and cheaper. Like, we get very cheap sets from the Far East. And even in the villages, especially as the national electricity grid spreads. I mean, yeah. Even in the villages. Many villages.
How does television fit back? I want to go back to the general mix of information, political information, news coverage that Ghanaians get.
Well, I suspect, I mean, television is not that important. I mean, radio is by far the more important. But as you know, television by its video format is a very powerful medium. Although it's not that important, I mean, for those who regularly rely on it. And also, I think there's more of a tradition in Ghana of families getting together, for instance, to watch the 7 o'clock news on television.
Interesting.
I don't think there's a big tradition of listening to the news on radio. Whereas, I might be wrong in this, but I think pretty much people tend to make arrangements to watch the television news.
Are people watching CNN in Ghana?
Yeah. I mean, we show, even on the open-to-air national station, I think they show CNN about 2-3 hours. I mean, they are not like in the very early morning, late at night. But the interesting thing is, if you watch the Ghana news on the state channel, a lot of the pictures they show for the international news are actually from CNN.
But is there enough CNN exposure in Ghana to affect the thinking of your students, for example, their knowledge of the world?
Yeah, well, I mean, first taking the cognizance of the point I've made about under-mediatization, that the Ghanaian society is not sufficiently mediatized. Within that small scope, yes, I think CNN controls a big chunk of it.
Interesting. I want you to explain the Ghana media to me. I'm just struck by how vital it looks in terms of diversity of newspapers, not great depth, but apparent freedom, and on the airwaves, kind of a vigorously free, admittedly commercial, but open, competitive, and interesting set of choices. I mean, you can turn on your radio and run down that FM dial. I read in the Financial Times in London that 5-10 years ago, virtually none of those stations were there.
That's true.
There seems to be a kind of blossoming of media in Ghana. What does that tell you? And what does it tell you about the politics?
It's something that has been struggled for. I mean, I didn't.
How so?
Well, like, I mean, our constitution was made very clear that the government should not be able to control the media.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all sorts of arms length arrangements were put in place. And even beyond the constitution, like, I mean, talk about radio, for instance, I mean, particular people had to stick their necks out to ensure to test the constitutional provision on the freedom to broadcast. So, I mean, this is some, yes, I mean, I agree with you that we are enjoying a very active media scene, but this is a fruit of quite difficult struggle.
Is it secure for the future? Is this going to?
I think so, pretty much so. I think it will be very, very difficult for any government to be able to roll it back.
Who owns the newspapers, and what do they express in terms of sort of political outlook?
I think it tends to be quite a close relationship between ownership of the newspapers and managing them. In other words, many of the newspapers are owned by their editors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Especially the private ones.
This is good, isn't it?
Well, it also has its problems.
As opposed to purely corporate and commercial media.
Yeah. No, we don't really have that. I mean, it's not developed. I mean, the journalists have been wanting that. I mean, like, big businessmen putting in money to establish newspapers. Actually, in Ghana, that's seen as something not to be good. As of now, the journalists themselves struggle to get some money and set up the papers. There are a few other examples, but that's a dominant trend. Now, the difficulty that has developed is that somehow there's a certain perception that the media men, the accountability of the media is more difficult to exact. Because if I own my own newspaper and I'm editing it, I can pretty much say whatever I want. And actually, there have been instances where I think there have been implications that kind of power has been misdirected.
I also read, I think it was in a report from London, but that talk radio contributed significantly to President Kufuor's victory. What's the logic there?
Well, I think it made some contribution. I must confess to you, the first time I ran Choice FM, the station we are on now, it was exactly on this point. I think the media effect has been grossly exaggerated. It was important, but I mean, as you would know, measuring media effect is a very tricky business.
Yes.
I mean, I always tell my journalist friends, for instance, when I think Margaret Thatcher won his last victory, The Sun came up with this headline, The Sun won it, The Sun in London. And they were claiming that it was because of that music fight that Margaret Thatcher was able to win when many people expected her to lose. And then there's been a lot of academic discussion trying to go through the complications of the effects of the media. The mantra now, and I think, I mean, the Kufuor government itself accepts that, is that yes, the radio stations help to win the election. But I've heard it being said, for instance, that they won in every region where there were private radio stations. My own suspicion is that the association is not that close. I mean, definitely the radio stations help, but I suspect we typically exaggerate the importance of the radio stations in that. I mean, the point is...
Why would radio stations have helped Kufuor? What was the logic there? I don't...
It's at various levels. That's why, I mean, of course, if you want to do a rigorous study of it, you have to break down the argument into its various testable points. I mean, at one level, it's just a simple issue, and that was pretty important, of simply policing the election. Like, on the day of the election, whenever there was a problem somewhere, somebody would ring a radio station and say, let's say the polling station next to X, Y, and Z, this is happening, that is happening. And so just that public exposure guaranteed the sanctity of the election to some extent.
Right.
The other thing is that, of course, the government had a big advantage in the state-owned media. So that the fact that the radio stations had this, the political parties had this, the private vector was important. The other thing is that I think that it exercised a certain fear. The fact that you could hear ordinary people ring up radio stations and say, I wouldn't vote for X, Y, and Z,
right.
You know, it emboldened people. I mean, there's the spiral of silence here. I mean, you hear somebody voicing out very strongly this way or the other, and a certain sense of community was developed. And essentially, the opposition parties benefited more from this kind of process. Right.
It gave a certain spine and confidence to the opposition.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough. I want to come back to globalization by way of media here. We haven't spoken at all tonight what I've been hearing so much about in Ghana, and that is the internet and the web as it is the global medium.
Hmm.
And there was a telecom summit in Accra this week, and ICANN has been gathering all the kind of internet super professionals to talk about the future of the web. We've also been talking about it here, as many people think the great hope of a kind of equalizer in a universal conversation. I want to hear the Professor Amos's view of the web and where it's going to take us, what it's going to do for you, as well as for your own, to me, enormously interesting web page called africatalks.org. What is your line?
Well, I do a lot of work on the web. I mean, I started using online facilities even before the web was invented. I had an email from the early 80s. So, and I do a lot of research as well on the social impact of ICTs. And I've heard these arguments quite a bit. In a place like Ghana, I think it's very easy to exaggerate the possible impact of the web. Yes, it's going to be a leveler, and so on and so forth. But when we talk about a digital, the digital divide, for instance, I mean, normally we think about it, the haves and have-nots. We think about it in international terms, between what is it, Ghana and the US or whatever. But there's a much more important local digital divide. In point of fact, if you step out of Accra, your access to internet technologies is seriously compromised. I mean, even from Kumasi.
There are not cafes in Kumasi?
There are a few cafes in Kumasi, not as many as in Accra. Many of them make phone calls to Accra to be able to access the web, so their charges are much higher. And I mean, the cyber cafe culture in Kumasi is not as good as it is in Accra for that.
Give it a year.
More than a year. I mean, it's been like this for quite some time.
But then, do you think it's just a matter of time? I mean, project it, give it a little room to expand. What is the promise of it? What's the effect of it going to be, do you think?
I think it's important. I mean, we also have to try to work out what people are doing on the net. You see, we don't have enough local content. I mean, that's why we think Africa Talks is quite important. We don't have enough local content on the web as of now, just by looking at screens at the cyber cafes.
Well, local content meaning made in Ghana.
Made in Ghana, turns on the web.
Yeah.
Or turns that are done from a Ghanaian perspective on the web.
Yeah, interesting point.
I would say that just looking at the screens at the cyber cafes, about 70% of web activity is actually emailing from web-based programs. And as we know from research, email is actually the most important, most popular web technology. So, I mean, that's not such a pattern. Now, if you look at most of the claims that we typically make about the revolutionary impact of the web, yes, being able to email one-on-one is an important part of it. But actually, I think a lot of the claims are based on this idea, essentially, of web pages. People sending, well, yes, I mean, other forms of customization and so on and so forth. What I'm trying to say is that really the web is a new technology, but for most of us, it's just a short step. We're still doing very much our traditional functions, but in a better enabled way using this new internet technology. It's not a big revolution that a lot of the stories of transformation, web-based transformation, seem to think.
I think you're, well, I'm going to be the romantic again. I think you're being a little bit of the skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it seems to me the most important thing about the web is just that it's there, that anybody entering a cyber cafe in Accra knows immediately, with so many implications, that he or she is in a global net as we've never been before. Costs practically nothing. It takes but a fraction of a second, and suddenly you know that you are in a global community. That seems to me almost more important than whether you're watching pornography or writing to your mother in Los Angeles. It's simply knowing that there's a complete new perspective available to anybody. And I'm also struck in the cyber cafes that I've watched in Ghana, young people can learn this technology, they can learn all the tricks very, very quickly, and they can teach themselves most of the way.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it feels to me like a much more radical step.
Well, I'm happy to remain a skeptic. I understand your points, but still, I think it's a small step. You see, we have a way of being able to adopt new technologies, whether the video or whatever, and still use it to tell the same story.
Of course.
And I think really that's what is happening with the internet. I mean, it's not as revolutionary as a lot of you nets.
I'm not a nethead.
Or techno optimists make it out to be. I mean, people are.
No, human discourse is human discourse.
Yeah.
John Perry Barlow likes to say that, you know, he talks to his mother on the web, but he's been talking to his mother in many media all his life.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, as a wee tot, we're writing letters from school, or making phone calls.
Yeah.
And in the end, it's all about talking to your mother.
Yeah.
And the medium itself perhaps is not critical, and it's not about the technology, and it's not about even the medium, and yet the range of conversation and the sense of membership in this human enterprise is completely new on the web.
Yeah, that's true. Another thing you should realize is that the experience of the web for most Ghanaians. It's not some, I don't want to mention names, but there are a few new cyber cafes with pretty fast connections and so on and so forth. For most Ghanaians, the experience of, if you are in Medina or if you are in downtown Accra, Solaga Market and so on and so forth, the experience of the web is normally one dial-up connection split to about 20 computers. So it's a quite slow medium, and it's not the web as you know it.
True. But this will change too. This will develop, will it not?
It would. Well, it's not changed at the rate that we expected. I mean, these things have been the same in Ghana for about 2 years now, in Accra for about 2 years now.
With what impact do you think?
Well, I mean, the point I keep getting back to is that, I've read a lot of, terms which are projecting these internet-based revolutions. And a lot of the assumptions behind them, I cannot see in Accra. For instance, about 80% of the people in these cyber cafes don't even know that you can open more than one window when you're on the web. So you go to Solaga Market, for instance, and they are charging the same as they charge in the, what I want to become known as Silicon Drive in Accra.
Yes.
The stretch of
Ring Road.
So, the poor man is sitting there waiting for about 5 minutes for Hotmail to open up and so on and so forth. And he gets into his mail, he sends a couple of messages to his relatives abroad and so on and so forth. Yes, you get much more communication than him going to make a phone call to talk to his, brother or his sister in the States. But that is not a sort of expectation that people make when you read First Monday or so on and so forth, whatever internet newsletter or magazine that discusses internet issues, and they are talking about how the internet will change the third world. People are assuming that you have a fairly fast connection, and if even you cannot buy things on it, you can see things you want on it, you can compare prices and so on and so forth. And that is not, we are very far from now.
Do you like the idea of the world talking to itself a lot more or not? I do.
I mean, that's why we're investing a lot of time and effort in Africa Talks, for instance. I mean, we have quite a number of things.
Yeah, for a skeptic, you're deeply invested in your
page. No. I mean, I as I told you, I study ICTs a lot. But I also know there's a lot of hype on it.
Of course there is.
There's a lot of hype on its social impact.
But project your own hopes for Africa Talks. I mean, leave the web itself aside. What do you want to do with that page? It seems to me to be a terrific forum for a very deeply expanding conversation.
Yeah, we have various. We as promoters, we have certain ideas, but as we keep saying, we hope that the effort will be owned by the members themselves so that they can also drive it. For me, for instance, eventually, and I'm beginning to see that a bit, because when I go to the cyber cafes on the campus, I change all their homepages to Africa Talks. And one thing that I find important, interesting is that the students are so interested that so immediately open up the computer, they can see somebody they recognize.
Yes.
So that in a sense, it's not even the global aspect of it, it's the local networking aspect of it.
Yes.
So that you can read this, the the view of Collins on globalization, on the future, on broadcasting or whatever. I mean, I think that is what is really causing the revolution in Lagos now, in Africa Talks.
Yes.
That on this sort, what used to be a quite distant medium is suddenly become local.
Yes. Well, I think that's something that has to be said, that it's not just the global aspect of it, but I think the web is a terrific community building tool.
Yeah.
And it can be very local, it can be very specific, it can be very political. But it's a way of an instant sharing of concern and expression on African identity or African possibility. I also noticed that there are web pages and web conversations, web forums that are very inviting and very they just have a lot of glue in them. And then there are others that very quickly become sort of flame throwing arenas. And Africa Talks looks to me like a one where you can build a sustained conversation.
We hope. I mean, there's a whole act of building online communities, I think.
Yeah, that's
I mean, about it. I'm an editor on HNET. HNET is Humanities and Social Sciences Online. I mean, HNET, I think, is perhaps the most important cluster of academic discussion lists.
Uh-huh.
I edit each Africa poll on it, but they have about at least 70 other lists for discussion of various academic topics. And in HNET, there's a lot of discussion, training on how to develop online communities. I think it's a whole art in itself, and definitely we intend to intentionally manage Africa Talks in such a way that it's exciting to the community. I mean, it's something they want to identify with.
This is a big question, how you use it, not for mere information, much less just argument, but community building. Do you have an idea of what the secret could be?
Well, I mean, the big experiment we try now, and I think it's been working so far, is essentially a bridge building mentality. Now, as I said, I mean, we try to build bridges between the university-based community, because that's our natural base, and other youth groups. So that, I mean, I'm really working intensively with some musicians, for instance. We're also working intensively with some visual artists and so on and so forth. So that, I mean...
What is it you want to do with musicians? It's a beautifully designed page you have. It's visually sophisticated, but what is it you want to do with musicians?
Yeah, eventually I hope I'll get some permission to put some sound on it and so on and so forth. But most important, I mean, really, I want to get them to contribute. I mean, already we have some contributions from key musicians in this country we're going to upload soon. But most importantly is just to give them a voice even beyond singing. So that's like, if them, what does Natsbu, Amanzila Natsbu, for instance, what does he think about globalization? What does Ekwalabi think about the youth and culture? And so on and so forth. So, I mean, I think these things you can easily pick up. I mean, in England, for instance, if you read Q or Mojo, any of these magazines, I mean, you tend to develop an idea of these stars as whole personalities, which in Ghana, as far as I can determine, it's not easy to do. There are a few ways in which media products allow you to do that, but it's not easy. I mean, all these people become, if I'm a university lecturer, I'm a essentially an university lecturer. If you're a musician, you're a musician. You are what your profile says you are. and we want to help to break that.
What does the internet do to the commercial value of the culture you're talking about, including the musical?
Well, the theory is that from exposure, perhaps even from retailing, the possibilities for retailing and so on and so forth, it would further energize the commercial value of these things. I don't think it's been happening really yet. I mean, we've had all sorts of problems with electronic commerce ventures in this country, most importantly because of difficulties with payment mechanisms and so on and so forth. But at the very least, I think that just for exposure, like on Africa Talks, we've already sold some paintings on Africa Talks. We've really not devised a strategy for, eventually with the visual artists we are working with, we're going to get them something by being enabling them to sell their waste. My guess, by having some art waste on our homepage, people are writing to us, I want to buy this painting, and we sold some paintings that way.
But you were speaking earlier about capitalizing on African content and culture. In the States, surely, the musicians feel that the record industry feels that the web is sooner or later going to destroy the value of content. Somebody says that, well, this is sort of an American joke, but I mean that the web will do for intellectual property what the Xerox machine did for government secrecy. I mean, it is just.
We are nowhere near any Napster-like technologies. I think for most Ghanaian musicians, the exposure that we can manage in the next 5 years, I don't think will harm any Ghanaian musician. We have big constraints. I mean, bandwidth constraints, technical constraints, and so on and so forth.
Hmm.
So, from the musicians I've spoken, both the musicians and the visual artists I've spoken to, this has not really come up. I think beyond a certain threshold, I mean, these kinds of concerns will be increasingly more important. But now the point is, their markets get so restricted that the sense I get is that for many of them, just any further exposure, of course, there's some guarantees. I mean, and also, we are not in a sales model where, for instance, you will download the music of musicians on the net. I don't really think so. I mean, it will always imply some mechanism for actually delivering the music in some other form to you, by post or whatever.
This is the theory that sort of any exposure is good exposure, and that further exposure on the web.
That's an impression.
Well, a lot of musicians in the States feel that way too, especially of the younger, smaller variety, that this is going to be a good thing for them. We're talking about globalization, and by now many, many meanings of it, with the global professor, Amos Anyamedu. I mean, you are something of a global institution. I didn't realize how far and wide you have studied and taught. Ghanaian by birth, Ghanaian in undergraduate education, but also Northwestern in the United States, and you've taught pretty much everywhere.
Well,
in the States and in Europe and in Africa.
And Australia.
And Australia.
Mm.
You're something of a global institution yourself.
No, I guess. Everything on the global system.
I want to go back over some of the things we said that sort of begin to sum things up almost by category in terms of globalization, good and bad, dangerous and not so dangerous, promising, destructive. I mean, you've touched on a lot of points here. Bring it back to economics, where you began.
Well, I mean, I said, yes, Africa is marginalized in terms of the global economy, but it's also true that the global economy affects us in a very negative way. So the challenge for Africa is actually to create some more space for maneuver, some more space to determine our own national or regional priorities, even as the world globalizes.
In terms of commodity markets, I mean, what is the effect of a trading world without boundaries on the things Africa exports, both mineral and agricultural?
That's an interesting question. Well, I think there are ways in which we could benefit from that, because for instance, a lot of our commodities, especially if you take the edible ones, which were essentially limited to our former colonial powers, like you could get pineapples, Ghanaian pineapples in England, for instance, because they had a relationship with them. I hear that increasingly Japan has become a very good market for African fruit, especially if you can prove that it's organic or that it's been produced under quite good hygienic conditions. And that's part of globalization. I mean, our former president used to say that the first thing that the former East Europeans looked for when they were liberated was to look for a banana. That might be globalization. There are ways in which, globalization can help the commodities. But having said that, I think the freedom, the theoretical freedom of globalization also means that the velocity of price changes can become bigger. Because like for cocoa, for instance, we had not a cartel, but a price management mechanism through the cocoa organization and so on and so forth. Such mechanisms have become less favored under this globalization mantra. So
that's just what I was going to ask you. How much room does Africa have to protect itself in this regime? Is it going to have a choice about protecting?
I think so. It's a matter. It's a challenge. I mean, theoretically, I think it makes it more difficult for us to protect. But I mean, it's also something that can be politically managed. I don't think we've tried to exact the influence that we can wield. I mean, for instance, I mean, this whole point about the African Union, for instance.
Yes.
I mean, if we act, because certain, even for oil, if we take the entire African contribution to the global market, it's not an insignificant sum. I mean, for the United States, for instance, I'm sure, I mean, you keep talking about the Middle East, but I'm sure at least maybe more than 50% of the oil actually comes from Africa, between Nigeria and Angola, and so on and so forth.
50% of North American imports, surely.
It is, I'm not too sure, but I'll not be surprised if that's the case. But I know Angola supplies quite a big chunk in Nigeria, and I mean, the little oil producers, I mean, Gabon and so on and so forth. So what I'm saying, I mean, but the more important point that I'm making is that there are several commodities for which Africa as a whole controls a sizable chunk of global supply, but we are not able to exert our influence out of it because we are divided in all sorts of ways.
There's a caller on the line. Welcome to the conversation.
Hello.
Hello,
Prof. Good evening.
Good evening to you.
Can I make a contribution? No, Prof, I just heard you sentence or whatever you said. The contribution was on the impact of globalization on African economy. Do you think this actually had a positive impact on our economies? Because you had already said we are more of a commodity exporting countries. Therefore, we'll be exporting by the point that we...
Hello?
Hello? I think he's made his point.
I think we lost... Do you want to respond?
Yes. Well, first of all, let me just be clear to my listeners that Chris keeps using professor in the American sense, or the British sense.
What's the difference?
America, almost anybody who teaches in the university is a professor. But in Ghana, a professor is a particular status, which I don't have.
Okay.
What was I going to say? Yes, I mean, whether...
Should I call you doctor?
Exactly.
Thank you, pardon. Okay.
Whether globalization is good for African economies. I think it's a difficult question, I mean, to answer in a clear-cut kind of way. Yes, international trade, if you look at the proportion of GDP, that's the total stock of goods and services the country produces, which we actually trade internationally. For many African countries, it tends to be lower than you expect for many countries. So on that basis, you could say that, well, international trade is not as important for us as for this. But the difficulty is that international trade provides a big chunk of our actually disposable income, or the more liquid aspects of our income. In a sense that if you leave aside what we trade internationally, a lot of the goods and services we produce, in fact, some of them are not even exchanged. It's just for direct consumption and so on and so forth. So you see that Africa's, the significance of the global in our wealth, African welfare, then becomes suddenly, it goes way up. So it's a dicey situation. I mean, for Ghana, for instance, I mean, in any case, that's very much the government's, I mean, position. And you also have to factor in the response of the various countries to globalization. I think certain countries have said, this is not too good for us. But in Ghana, from what I can determine, the MPP government is going all the way for globalization.
You know, it reminds me, I keep wanting to ask people here about Kwame Nkrumah.
Mm-hmm.
One of his big and frustrated drives was for greater African unity,
mm-hmm.
And bigger instruments of African unity. I want to ask you, what would an Nkrumahist perspective be on African unity in this global contest? But before you answer it, I want to hear from a caller too. The phone is 70 11 100 or 70 11 200. Caller, thank you for joining us. Are you there? Hello? Caller, did we lose you? He's gone. He went to bed.
Maybe.
What is the prospect of African unity in this global scene?
I mean, the whole issue of the relationship between regionalism and globalization has become very difficult. I mean, definitely when Nkrumah was arguing for African unity and so on and so forth, regionalism at the African level was to shield us from globalization.
Was he anticipating globalization, you think?
Well, the word was not there, but also...
I mean, that was really a very different setting of anti-colonial politics, was it not?
Maybe not, because there's a big argument as to how new globalization is. I mean, Professor Ali Mazuri, who was talking to Ligon, over the past few days, for instance, argues very strongly that globalization is not really new. I mean, globalization has been occurring in phases for over the last 100 years or so. So that, I mean, I think the sort of arguments that Nkrumah and Co were engaging were not very different. But the more important point is that in those days, when people used to talk about integration, regional integration was a shield against the global. Whereas it appears to me that today, when we talk even about the African Union and so on and so forth, actually the African Union and so is supposed to facilitate globalization. So that whereas before, regionalism seem to be in competition with globalization. Now, it appears regionalism is increasingly being developed as a complement to globalization.
What instruments would Nkrumah be looking for today that Africa doesn't have? In other words, what would his structure of a united Africa look like?
I mean, at the level of institutions, it's not very different from what we're trying to do with African Union. African Parliament, the common currency, so on and so forth. Of course, one of the things that was most notable was the idea of the African High Command. I mean, that is not so much in the structures of the African Union now.
I should know, but I don't. What is the drive for African Union? Where does it stand at this point?
Oh, we've just passed a treaty for a new African Union, and it's going to be launched African countries. That we're changing the OAU, what's it called? We're changing the OAU into the African Union, and it's going to be launched in July, coming July.
Is there a caller on the line? Caller, are you there? Hello? Caller, were you there? Hello? Okay, no caller. Forgive me, I should know about the African Union, but and I don't. Is this clearly in the future as much as the euro has...
I think it's shamelessly based on the European examples. So they're going to have an African currency, they're going to have an African parliament, African court, and so on and so forth. But yes, so the treaty has been signed, ratified by the required number of countries. And in July, in South Africa, they are going to launch it there. So the OAU is going to be transformed. The OAU is going to become the African Union.
When do we get a common currency through all of Africa?
That's a good question. I think if they've made, in West Africa, we are aiming at a common currency by 2004. And there's a timetable for all this. I mean, I don't know how far we'll be able to meet the deadlines.
I want to, we've only 10 minutes left, but I want to throw out a rather difficult last question on globalization. It seems to me Africa is the the center, in a certain way, of the universal burden of slavery and the story of slavery, the reality of slavery, the reality that that Africa had its own sad part in the history of it, as the worst sufferer, the most exploited piece of it, but also the African slave trade was part of the villainy in it too. Seems to me this somehow underlies a great deal of the modern mind, the modern thinking, the burden of our history. Will Africa? Will we extend that conversation about this kind of universal shame of the history of slavery that we all, I suppose, have to contend with someday? Is the world ready for a global conversation about slavery in our past?
Well, I mean, from the history of the Durban Conference on Racism a few months ago, I don't think the world is really ready for that. But I mean,
that's the right answer too. I hadn't even thought of it in that term, but it just shows. But now there's an interesting point, because the Bush administration withdrew from the conference in Durban.
Yeah, yeah.
A matter of like, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before September 11th,
mm-hmm.
The event that has kind of re-engaged George Bush in the world. I've thought, just as a private citizen, that, you know, if he had to do it again after September 11th, we wouldn't leave the conference in Durban.
I suspect so.
And I think he would be, well, who knows? I think it's a conversation that is going to come back.
Hmm.
Is it not, or?
Yes, I suspect so. I must confess, I honestly felt the World Racism Conference was a bit over-engineered, in the sense that we had not really prepared the building blocks for that kind of conversation. Then suddenly there's this big UN conference and you have to confront.
It was over-engineered or under-engineered, maybe?
Over. Well, I'm saying over.
Under-prepared?
It was coming from the top.
Yes, okay.
More like it was coming from the top. And the, like, building blocks in Ghana, for instance. In point of fact, Ghana, we have a very interesting case, because one of the preparatory meetings for that actually became a very controversial meeting. But I mean, our own domestic consultations before the Durban conference.
What was the controversy in Ghana?
I don't remember the specifics very well. What we did is we had a number of, I think, 3 meetings around the country for people to talk about discrimination and so on and so forth. And one of them was done, actually, they were trying to capture Boko, which was, I mean, Boko is in the upper eastern corner of the country and had just been. There have been various local wars there. So the UN system did this meeting, not in Boko, in Bolgatanga, which, as it were, the Boko guys allowed to pass. Then they tried to do a second meeting, a follow-up meeting, and that was a flop. Essentially, because I think what I'm trying to make out of it is that it appears to me what the combatants in Boko were saying was that we still have our differences. And this enforced conference is somewhat trying to paper over the differences.
What is the difference?
It's a very complicated issue. I mean, we've had a system of conflicts in the north of Ghana. Yeah. Essentially, they all revolve around the dynamics between chiefship and the modern state. You see, some societies are supposed not to have chiefs, or are deemed not to have chiefs by the British. So they put them on the other societies who are supposed to have chiefs. And now, so the modern state also had problems dealing with this issue, essentially, I mean, to put it cryptically.
So, well, you know, the debate tends to, it can run in the direction of reparations, but it seems to me that it can also run in the direction of a sort of spiritual inquiry about evil, about exploitation, yeah, about forgiveness, about the past, about guilt, about redemption. I wonder, does Africa have an appetite to be part of that conversation? Maybe even lead that conversation? I don't know.
There are big divisions in Africa. I mean, like during the Durban conference, for instance, Mugabe, for instance, became the champion of the reparations debate.
Well, that immediately, you know, makes people terribly defensive and think of economic interests, and they get terribly uptight.
That's a challenge, but there have been, actually there was a committee, I think it was an OAU committee, which was chaired by the late Chief Abiola, and Professor Ali Mazuri was one of the leading lights on that committee. And they did a lot of work, I mean, trying to make the argument that we shouldn't feel that kind of guilt. I mean, it's something we're entitled to, more or less. I mean, it was a kind of a rights-based approach to the whole thing. And of course, there are also important people in Africa who argue like along the lines you are arguing, like President Ward of Senegal, who's come out against reparations because he thinks that it demeans Africa. The slave trade is a horrible thing that you can never put a price on it, and so on and so on. It's a quite active debate. Even here in Ghana, there's a group in the Du Bois Center which is very active on this debate.
And how does it go? What is the Du Bois Center's line?
Well, I don't think it's formally affiliated to the Du Bois Center, but I know they used to be kind of in the Du Bois Center. That is a very strong argument for reparations. In fact, I think there's some kind of Pan-African movement which has developed headquartered here in Ghana. And essentially, it's a campaign for reparations.
Do Ghanaians argue this among themselves? The burden of
actually, that's a good point to make. Because this Du Bois Center effort I'm describing is actually championed by.
I'm talking about reparations within Ghana. Among is the responsibility for the slave trade inside West Africa documented? Is it researched? Would people know how to make reparations if it came to making them within?
Within
this world.
I've not heard. I've not heard a reparations debate in the domestic slavery context, but in terms of that being documented, I think the situation in Ghana is one of the best documented. Now, as you know, Louis Gates' series on the Wonders of Africa,
yes,
one of the most controversial points was this whole point about domestic slavery. And I would say a lot of the hard work was actually based on research done here in Ghana. I mean, that Akosi Apebi in the history department, I mean, he really started Gates off on this whole point about the African responsibility for slavery, or at least partial responsibility for slavery.
Did Ghanaians watch that series?
Yes. I myself, I did. I don't think it's been shown on Ghanaian television, but it was publicly shown in the American embassy. And as part of Black History Month, I think the year before last, I was part of a discussion which discussed the series and so on. And I think it's fairly well known in Ghana.
Professor, I mean, I shouldn't say that. I won't say it again. Dr. Amos Anyamado, this is a hugely interesting evening for me and a short course in almost everything. I hope we'll get a chance to continue it. But I want to thank you very, very, very much for leading us through a whole series of considerations of the meaning of globalization. A valuable night for me, and I hope for our listeners too. I want to thank especially Dr. Amos Anyamado from the University of Ghana, but also our Choice 102.3 FM producers, Mohammed Nabil and Emmanuel Gamadi, and the program director, Larry Benson. Wide World is a joint production of Radio Choice and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. I'm Christopher Lydon. Good night.